God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name, and you are able to unmute if you would like to say hello.
Hi, my name's Randy, and I relapsed recently, and I'm about 7 days sober.
Randy, welcome. Glad you're here, brother.
I'm Gail, and I've got 2 more days to my 30 days.
Whoop, whoop, Gail. Welcome. Wonderful. Anybody else? Going once, going twice. All right. Mr. Mike F., would you help me out with the AA preamble, please? I'm going to put that on the screen.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thanks, David.
Thank you, sir. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we're very excited to have John T. from NYC come and tell his story. And after John speaks, we'll take a short break at the top of the hour, call for announcements, Seventh Tradition, etc. And then we'll reconvene and ask the questions to John. And the questions that we're going to ask him are questions that you submit. So please send your questions in to the user questions. Really excited to have John here tonight. He was highly recommended. And Chris S. is the one who threw you under this bus. I don't want to take up another minute of your time, brother. Thank you for coming to share with us tonight.
Yes. Yes. Okay. My name is John Troche. I'm an alcoholic, and it is a pleasure and an honor to be here and speak with you tonight. Chris is a great guy, and I'm sure you've heard him speak before. He's got a hell of a story. And, you know, it's interesting as people were introducing themselves, and, you know, sometimes we forget that there's people that are new and just coming back. You know, I get so used to all of the old faces and people that, you know, we take for granted the miracle that this thing is. I mean, it really is impressive. It is something when you realize how many people are walking around with substantial amounts of sobriety, you know, and sometimes I can forget, you know, momentarily, but I can forget what it was like when I couldn't put any time together. And that was my experience for a long time. So if there's anybody who's new, just coming back, you're not familiar with so much with what we do here, I'm just going to tell you my story. I'm going to tell you what I was like, what happened in my life, what I'm like now. I am an Olympic level maniac for sure. And I'm not going to try and give you too many war stories, but I'm going to give you some of the history just to highlight what we're talking about here. So I guess the best place to start is to start the first time I got drunk. And, you know, I was just a little kid, really. And, you know, what I knew about alcohol was I came from a family of drinkers. I still come from a family of drinkers. I mean, my family likes to put them down. And just because someone likes to put them down doesn't make them an alcoholic. I have a lot of heavy drinkers in my family. But I noticed from a very early age, there were certain things that were very attractive to me, you know. And one of the things I noticed was when the family would get together, and I have a very big family, and they'd start knocking them back, you know, people started getting looser. They started getting funnier. They started laughing. They were having fun. They didn't seem so tense. very loud family. I talk very loud, and people sometimes think I'm yelling. I'm not yelling. I'm talking to you. I'm telling you something. And that's, you know, my family is like that. And I was just attracted to the chaos, you know, whatever it was inside of me from a very early kid, and whatever's up with me, it predated ever picking up a drink, but I didn't know this. And so I knew that there was something about alcohol that I found attractive, and it was something that I wanted to do. And I associated it with being older. So obviously when you're a kid, you want to, you know, you always want something that you don't have. So I wanted to be all grossed up, you know? And so I'm like 13 years old. It's summertime. Nobody's home. I had drank before, but I'd never gotten drunk, you know, like sips off dad's beer, stuff like that. And this memory is like, it's like tattooed inside of my head, because the memory is, and there's aspects of the memory that are very foggy to me, and other aspects that are in like hyper, ultra color, you know, like I could really see it vividly. And, I don't remember who told me about this, softball game that was going to be happening, but you know, one of my buddies did, I guess. I don't remember who it was, but there was going to be a softball game, and there was going to be all kinds of kids there, older kids too. And I was a little bit nervous about that. And I didn't know at that time why I was nervous. I just had this, you know, some anxiety about that, you know, am I going to be accepted? Am I going to fit in? You know, is it going to be okay? And then I just developed this plan in my head. And the plan was I was going to go into mom's liquor cabinet. I was going to get whatever I was going to get. Turned out I took rum. I was going to put it in like a little bottle, and I was going to head to the field. And I was just going to, you know, hit it up. And I don't even know where that plan really came from. You know, I don't know why that came up, but it did. And I'm walking to the field. I'm halfway there, and I'm not walking anymore. I'm floating. I mean, something happened to me on my way to that softball game that was like the, what we talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about the spiritual awakening and the spiritual experience. And man, did I have a spiritual awakening that day. I had a spiritual experience. And I realized, like, by the time I got to that field, something happened. And what happened was I was no longer anxious about being at that field. In fact, I was like the complete opposite. And when I got there, I really felt like the people there were lucky that I was there, you know, and I felt like I was with all my new best friends, and all my self-consciousness was gone. And it was just like something awoke inside. I never forget this little girl, Meredith. She saw me and her eyes lit up, and she came running towards me. She threw her arms around my neck. And she was so happy to see me. She had never done that before. And after that day, never did it again. But damn, I knew something worked. Like there was something like this. This was like everything was clicking on all cylinders. And in this memory that I have, I don't ever remember actually playing softball. You know, maybe we did, maybe we didn't, but I don't remember it. And by the time that we left, my buddy or one of my buddies, me and him started walking back to our, you know, to our street. And I'm lit up. I mean, I'm bad. And by the time I get home, mom is home from work. Like I said, it was summertime. We're on summer vacation. She's not. And I get home and she's there, and I try to sneak into the house like a ninja, and I get caught, and I get yelled at, and I get grounded, and I got sick. And I'll never forget the next day when I went over the day's events, the following day. I didn't think about getting sick or yelled at or grounded or any of like all of those things. And by the way, it is interesting. The first time I get drunk, there are consequences. And that would be a pattern throughout the rest of my life with me and alcohol. There would always be negative consequences. But, you know, at that day, when I thought about it, that was so not an important part of the story that I got in trouble. In fact, it was insignificant. It was a small price to pay. And I felt like I discovered something that totally changed my life. And later on, I was going to find out when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they talked about this condition of being restless, irritable, and discontent, easily annoyed and never satisfied. And that's without a drink in me. And what I came to find out was before I ever picked up a drink, I had that condition going on. And what happened when I picked up the drink was I discovered a solution to a problem that I never knew I had. And it changed me. It changed my life. Now, I'll just tell you, that next day, I'm going over these events in my head. And I said to myself, I said, I want to do that as much as I possibly can. It was like I found my thing. Like I just like something awoke inside of me, and that was going to be my thing. And that's what I went on to do. I just would do that as much as I possibly could. And it starts out, you know, I'm 13 years old and I'm like a little maniac. And you could basically fast forward my story from that point. And just every year I'm getting worse and worse. And like, I just, the important part to keep in your mind about what I was like in those years is I was like one of those kids that other parents would say to their kids, don't hang out with that kid. You should not be hanging out with that kid. It was very clear and very obvious to all of the, adult figures that were, witnessing what was going on in my life, that there was something very wrong and it wasn't going to end well. And it was like kind of horrific for my family to watch this. My father went to prison when I was 9 years old. He got 20 years. He got out when I was 29. And they were convinced that I was going to be just like him, that I would be that guy that if I was lucky, I would end up in prison. Most likely I would end up dead. And that's just the way it looked to the outside observer looking at my life. And to me, it looked like all of you are against me. All of you, like no matter what I do, you always have something to say. Nothing I can do ever satisfies anybody. Everybody is the fun police. Everybody has a problem. And the problem's not me, the problem is you. And you know what? You can go screw yourself. And I was belligerent. I was sarcastic. I was a cynic. And that's how, and that's just my personality type, that's the presentation of my personality. And I'm drinking, and there's other substances too, but this is Alcoholics Anonymous. So I will stick with that. And that will suffice. And you can fast forward my story to, I'm 18 years old and, I get in a car and, the only reason I got in the car was because I was being chased out of a house by a girl's mother. She's screaming at me, telling me she's going to call the police. And I get in my car. I just had gotten in that car 2 weeks earlier. And I try to escape. I don't know where I'm going. I just got to get out of there. And, on my way to wherever I thought I was going, I hit a parked car. And then I hit a second parked car, and then I fled the scene. And I kind of had that. I was in such a state. I basically thought, well, no one noticed that, right? Like that, no one could have possibly seen that. Let's just get out of here. And I'm driving, and my steering wheel is shaking in my hands. And then I hear that sound that none of us wants to hear. And I look in my rear view, and it looks like there's 50 cops chasing me. And I don't know why. I guess it's just the state that I was in of inebriation. I just had this overwhelming sense, this feeling, this impulse to just, I gotta get out of here. And so I get it in my head that I can somehow get away from the police. And they don't like that at all when you try to flee from them. I remember I'm driving and one of the cop cars comes right next to me and I'll never forget. I look to my left and I see this guy and he's screaming at me to pull over. And I go, geez, that guy looks mad. I ain't pulling over. And so he speeds up ahead of me and cuts me off. And so now at this point, I think my only course of action is to flee on foot, So I jump out of my car and I start running and he pulls out his gun. He yells, freeze. And I have a moment of clarity. I say to myself, man, I keep running. This guy's going to kill me. And they got me. Right. And that incident right there would be the incident that would eventually get me into Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. I was in a lot of trouble. Once again, by the way, from that first time of just a little bit of trouble to that time that I just said, a lot more trouble. And in between that, tons of trouble. So I'm in trouble again. And it's just like, everybody just looks at me and shakes their head. Like, what are you going to do with this person? And I'm lucky enough that my mother gets me a lawyer. And I have a lawyer who says to me, if you want the judge to do anything, do you any favors, you got to make it look like you're actually trying to get well. So I say, all right, whatever, what do I have to do? And he tells me I have to go to this program, and I go to this program, and they tell me in the program, in order to graduate, I have to go to at least 6 AA meetings and get this stupid paper signed. Now I'm 19 years old at this point, and I have no interest in AA. In my mind, AA was like, I don't know, it was like what I'd seen in movies. You know, it was like this place where people go to complain about the fact that they can't drink anymore. And by the way, I don't necessarily think that drinking is my problem, right? I had woken up in a hospital ward. I woke up in a hospital ward, and I look at the bed, and there's and it was one of those beds that had belts on it. And the night before, I had been belted to this bed because I tried to escape, and then I fought the doctors and the orderlies, and I was so out of control. The only thing they could do was belt me down and shoot me up with like Demerol or something, you know, they just shot me up. And about 2 days later, I guess I was on like maybe Thorazine or something. I was like, could hardly move, but I wake up in this bed and I'm lying there and I look, and at the door, it's like, there's an orderly sitting at the door. And I had that feeling. And I bet you everybody in this room has had this experience at least once in their life, where I hadn't even opened my eyes yet. It was like that moment, like when you're coming out of whatever you were in and you haven't even opened your eyes yet, but the sinking feeling starts to just flood you of, oh my God, something really bad just happened, or something really bad happened last night. It just all comes. And, you know, it came, and I've had that experience one time in Thailand, and I'll tell you, that's not the place you want to have that feeling, that's for sure. So I wake up, I come to in this hospital bed, And I'm lying there, and I realized I'd been in this place before. And I start having this memory of like this a nurse who was doing like an assessment or an intake or something. And she'd asked me the question. She said, "Do you know why you're here?" And I told her like what, you know, we tell people, like, well, it was a series of bad mistakes and misunderstandings. It was a he said, she said, you know, kind of situation. You know, you don't understand, I'm not to be blamed. You know, just all this nonsense about how it wasn't my fault. And she stopped me and she asked me this question. She said, "When you leave here, are you going to drink?" And I said, "Yeah, of course I'm going to drink. Didn't you hear what I just told you?" I told her, "Listen, alcohol is not my problem. I get what my problem is. I thought my problem was other, you know, substances. But alcohol, you know, you can go to any corner and get a bottle. Alcohol is not a big deal. Everybody drinks." You know, and that was how I looked at it. And she said to me, she goes, "Listen, I want to tell you something. And I don't know, I don't care if it's 10 years from now, 5 years from now, a year from now, whatever it is." She said, "If you leave here and you drink, you're going to end up back here or in a place like this." And I got to tell you, I looked her right in the eyes and I laughed in her face. I thought she was another person being melodramatic. Like, she's telling me this stuff to scare me straight. I just had a lot of people in my life who were just trying to scare me straight. That's how I looked at it. You're trying to scare me straight. And now I wake up in this bed and I realize it's not 10 years later, 5 years later. It's not even a year later. It's literally like 3 months later. And I'm back in that place that she said I'd be back in. And I'm going to tell you, when she said that, there was no way I thought I would ever be back in that place. And here I am. And it was, you know, there's a line in Bill's story where he talks about ominous warning, which I failed to heed. You know, and all of us, we have these ominous warnings that have come up in our life, these things that say, "Listen, man, you should probably take a look at this. Take a look. This is a problem." And how many times have we had those situations and we go, you know, and that's where I was. And so I come into Alcoholics Anonymous the first time, and I'm 19 years old, and I don't want to be here. I don't think I belong here. I don't know the nature of my illness. I don't know anything about the progressive nature of alcoholism. I don't know anything about the fatal nature of alcoholism. I don't know what you guys are talking about when you talk about the physical craving or the mental obsession. I mean, I'm having the experience of alcoholism for sure, but somewhere in my head, I think I can control this somehow. Like, I've seen people who seem to be able to somehow control this. And if they can do it, why can't I? I mean, like I told you earlier, in my family, I have a ton of heavy drinkers in my family. And you know what? They can drink with the best of them. And you know what they'll do the next day? They'll get up and they do what they got to do. Now, maybe they turn into alcoholics one day. Maybe they do. Maybe they don't. That's not for me to say, right? But they don't got what I got. Because what happens to me is I pick up, and once I start, I can't stop. So I'm at this, I go to my first meeting and I hate it. I get my paper signed. I just hate it. And I don't know anything about AA either. I don't know that there's meetings all over the place. I just think this one place, that's AA, you know? So like a week later, I come back again to the same place, you know, to AA. And I get my second, you know, my paper signed. It's my second meeting, right? Two down, four to go. You know, and I'm like, I get there, you know, like right on the buzzer, I get my paper signed and I buzz out. And then it was like the third meeting was like the magic meeting, like something happened. It's like God or the universe or something conspired to make something happen in my life, because something happened for sure. And I was basically, I was in a situation where if I would have gone home first, which is what I wanted to do, I would have been super late for this meeting, right? And so it was, we'll get to the meeting early or get there super late. So I go, I'll go to the meeting early. I'll find a little spot. I have this book that I'm reading. I'll go sit down and I'll read it and wait for this dumb meeting to start. And I get to this meeting, right? The meeting that I think is AA, right? And I get there and there's people like there. And like, I thought I was like super early. In reality, I might've been like maybe 20 minutes early, right? But in my mind, I think everybody gets there on the buzzer. So I'm like, what are all these losers doing here? I'm like, this is ridiculous. I don't know. And by the way, at this point in my story, I know nothing about AA. I don't know anything about it. Not really. I've gone to two meetings and I don't know about this thing called a greeter. And at the door was this young lady who is still sober to this day. God bless her. And every time I see her, I don't see her that often, but every once in a while I'll see her. And she is like, she will always be the welcoming face of AA to me when I first came to this organization. And it's amazing she's still sober after all these years. But you know, so she's this young lady at the time. And I go to walk into the door and she puts her hand down and she says, welcome. And I don't know what a greeter is. I don't know that she's just doing a job. I don't know that she's doing service. But that thing right there took me aback, that somebody would be welcoming me, a total stranger. And, you know, she's an attractive girl too. And I'm thinking, wow, this is amazing. Like, I can't believe how nice, like, this is nice. Like at that point in my life, people weren't welcoming me anywhere. People wanted me to go, like, just go, please. So she says, welcome. And I go, okay, that's kind of, and I go, thank you. And then she asked me, she goes, are you new? And it's funny because when we're new, we're so like out to lunch, because she asked me if I'm new and my answer is like, well, I've been to two meetings, so I guess I'm not new. You know, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. And then she asked me, she goes, do you have a sponsor? And now I'd heard about this thing called a sponsor. I heard people talk about it in the stupid program that I was in. And I definitely didn't want a sponsor. But I'll tell you this, if I was ever going to get a sponsor, I'd get a female sponsor. And then I start thinking, well, maybe she'd like to be my sponsor, or maybe she'd like to go out for a cup of coffee. I mean, I don't know. I'm confused at this point. I don't know. I think she welcomed me. She must like me, right? And so she asked me this question and all this stuff is going through my head. And she says, you know, do you have a sponsor? And I say, no. And I'm about to go into my whole spiel about how I'm not going to get a sponsor. And over on my shoulder, I hear somebody say, well, you got one now, kid. And I was like, what the hell is this? It was like this bait and switch moment. Now this other guy comes over and he goes, come here. He goes, let me talk to you. And I go, great. You know, what did I get myself into? And this guy goes, he asked me, he goes, do you have a big book? And I looked at him, I said, do you mean like a Bible? And he goes, no, that's the big, big book, kid. Come on, let me go get you a big book. And I go, okay. So he brings me downstairs and he gives me my first big book. Now, here's the thing. And you know what? It's like, it was like they had learned this little bait and switch move in like some kind of AA sponsorship, 12-step recovery school or something, because they performed it perfectly. I mean, they hooked me, right? Because now this guy gives me a book. He doesn't make me pay for it. He gives it to me. And then he said, and I'm like, all right, well, you know, this is nice, right? And then he's talking. He asked me this question. He goes, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober, right? Now, when he asked me that question, I tell him my first lie in AA. I say, yeah, sure, of course I am. I mean, I'm not willing to do anything to stay sober at that point. What I learned in my life is that people ask you a question, you tell them what you think they want to hear, right? Because, see, I know what's going on right now. This is what's going on in my head. This guy he might have some kind of secret that he might be interested in telling me. And if I tell him I'm not interested if I'm not willing to go to any length to say, he's not going to tell me whatever that secret is. So I'm going to play the game. I go along to get along. So I say, yeah, I'm willing. And then he's talking and I'm, you know, it's going in one ear and out the other. And then the last thing he says right before the meeting starts, he says, the meeting's about to start. You don't have to do anything when it does, but I'll make a suggestion. Try and sit down and listen to what these people have to say and just try and have an open mind. Now, I was waiting for him to ask me to do something difficult. You know what I mean? Because I figured here's where the hammer drops. But he just told me to do something pretty easy. Just sit down and try and have an open mind and listen to these losers, you know, in my head. Right. So I go, okay, I can do that. And I go and I sit down in the back of the room. I still picture it all in my head. I can see everything that's happening. And it's all the same people from the last 2 weeks. And when they were talking in the last 2 weeks, when they spoke, it sounded like they had their hands over their mouth. You know, like it was mumble, 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 Charlie Brown teacher. And like, I couldn't relate to anything they were saying. Now this meeting starts and I'm trying to listen with an open mind. And wouldn't you know, like everybody in there was sharing the most beautiful stuff you ever heard. It was the craziest thing. I'm like, I'm hearing some crazy stuff. Like, but I mean like good, not bad. And then I'm sitting there and I look and they have the shades up at the front of the room. And I start reading the 12 steps for the first time in my life. I'd never read them. I'd heard about 12 steps. I didn't know what they were. So I start reading them and I see God and I see God and I see God and I see God. And I say to myself, wait a second. I didn't know AA was about God. Now, here's the thing. I'm a good Catholic boy. I was raised Catholic. I had this belief in a higher power. And over the course of my life, that belief has at times been really strong and other times totally non-existent. But at that time in my life, because of all the trouble that I was in, I was willing to believe that maybe that was, you know, my last shot was maybe some kind of miracle. You know, that's what I was reading like spiritual books. That book that I was going to sit down and read, the name of it was called How to Find God. So I was like seeking at that point. And I had been praying, right? Like praying for some kind of help. And as I'm sitting there, all of a sudden it starts dawning on me as these people are talking and I see that God's in the steps and they're talking about like a higher power. And they're saying things like, I couldn't stop drinking. And then I came to this place and I discovered a power greater than myself and it totally changed my life. And they're just like different variations on that theme about this higher power. And I'm thinking, holy crap, like I've been praying to God and I've been like seeking something and I need something in my life. And all of a sudden it began to dawn on me that those prayers that I'd been saying, right? I didn't know if there really was something there listening to it, but suddenly I started to get this really spooky feeling like there was something and it had been listening to those prayers. And the weirdest thing was I'm sitting in this meeting and it's getting brighter, right? The meeting's getting brighter. I don't know why. And I'm getting like chills, you know, and I'm like, I'm listening to these people and I almost start laughing because it's like, I can't believe this is happening. And this is at my third AA meeting. And I start hearing in my head, like in my ears, there's a song by Bob Marley. It's called Three Little Birds. And in the chorus, he says, don't worry about a thing because every little thing's going to be all right. And that those words, I hear it in my ears, like just loud, you know. And the room's brighter and these people are the most beautiful people in the world. They're just like, I can't believe I'm so lucky to be here. And it dawns on me that when I had been praying to God, really what I had been praying for was like a new girlfriend or like a windfall of money. Like I was praying for some kind of outside thing to make me feel better, you know, because I'm that kind of guy. I think it's always going to be something out there that's going to make me feel better. It's going to do for me what I can't do. It's going to be something out there. And it's going to be like the shiny object. It's going to be something, you know, something sweet. It's going to be something good, something like that. And that's kind of what I had in mind. And what kind of blew my mind was in that moment, the realization that that was what I was praying for. And then the realization that whatever that higher power was that was answering my prayers was going to give me something way better than that. And that this was it, like AA was it. And I knew that if I kept coming to AA, I was going to be okay. I just knew it. I don't know why I knew that, but I just knew it. And I tell you, that night, that very night, the obsession to drink was removed from me that night. Now, I wish I could tell you that my story is from that moment, and that was 1993, to this moment, I never drank again, but that's not my story. See, my story is I did stay sober for a while that time. In fact, I stayed sober for 7 years, and my life got unbelievably good. I mean, I can tell you, like, I don't have enough time to really go into all the things that happened in that first time I was sober. I mean, my life totally changed. But I think what's an important part of my story that I try to talk about this when I speak is this illness of alcoholism. It doesn't just get arrested when you stop drinking. It doesn't just go away and slink off into a hole somewhere because now you're not drinking. No, it stays, right? And what happened to me was, yes, I did get better. And yes, I went through the steps and thoroughly, by the way. And I had an unbelievable experience. And I was a young guy in sobriety with the whole world was in front of me. I went back to school. I got my bachelor's degree at that point. I had a daughter. There's all these different things that were just amazing that happened in my life. But what happens for people like us is when God used to get all the credit for the good things that were happening in my life, suddenly at some point I started thinking, but I think maybe I had a lot to do with this. You know what I mean? Like I started thinking like, you know, I remember one time and I was on this kick for a while, where I would say to myself, you know, I'm pretty sure if I wanted to be a doctor, I could be a doctor. You know what I mean? Like, I thought I could do anything. I mean, the hardest thing I ever did in my life was get clean and sober. I mean, that really was going through the steps, especially the way they're laid out in the big book. That was the hardest thing I ever did. And it was the most work I ever put into something. And the payoff was tremendous. But what happens is if you don't continue on that path, meaning you don't continue to enlarge your spiritual life, the ego has its way of kind of slipping in there, right? And very sneaky too, because I didn't see it. You know, I didn't see it coming. And it's like the kind of thing where, you know, I'd been to thousands of meetings. I heard people talk about variations on that theme about the reemergence of the ego. And yet when I'm getting sicker, I don't see it, right? I'm in meetings and I'm getting sicker and I don't see it. And so what happens, right? Eventually the day comes where I've basically stopped doing the things that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't sponsor anymore. Not really. I'm not doing service anymore. I mean, don't ask me to help because I'm not interested. My attitude was like, hey, I did all that stuff. Like it's now my turn to not have to do it. My meditation practice gone. Prayer. That's a joke. I don't really pray anymore. Making amends, I mean, whatever, I'm not making amends. You make amends to me is basically my attitude now, right? Character defects are running rampant. I mean, I'm just doing whatever I want, right? And it starts out like seems like small things, but the small things, it's like a slippery slope. And then, you know, I'm not taking my own inventory anymore. I'll take your inventory. I know why you're screwed up, but I'm not taking my inventory. And, you know, God's not really the center, you know, a focus in my life. And my ego is really the focus in my life and what makes me feel good and what makes me look good. And what do I want? It's like, I need, give me, that's where I was. And so I'm living like that without a drink in the rooms of AA. But shocker, I'm starting to not like AA anymore. I mean, I'm one of those guys. I love AA. I love meetings. I think, thank God. I mean, I know people that have a hard time with meetings. I don't. And I mean, good meetings. You go to a good solution-based meeting. Oh man, I'm in. I love that. I want to hear people talk about their experience with the steps and with the higher power. I love that. And I know it's hard for some people. So I, you know, now all of a sudden I'm getting sicker and the meetings, and I'm not that crazy about the meetings anymore. And, you know, this one's a this and that one's a that, and the gossip and just the nonsense that, that we can get into. And slowly but surely I'm edging my way out of the fellowship. I'm not practicing program for a while. And then the insanity begins, and the insane idea that comes back is like, in whatever form it takes, it takes. But the insanity is, in some way, shape, or form, my mind has to start playing that game that somehow it's okay for me to pick up a drink again. Somehow it starts with the, well, you know, like on that particular relapse, it was, well, you know, when you were drinking, you were young, and, you know, lots of young people drink irresponsibly. I mean, go to any college campus, you can see that. That's a fact. Right? Not all those people are alcoholics. Maybe you weren't an alcoholic either. Maybe you were just bad. You know, you were just going through some psychological damage at that time. And now look at you. You've done, look how well you've done in your life. Right? And I was doing pretty well on the outside. And I was saying to myself, yeah, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Maybe if I drank now, I mean, shit, I've been sober 7 years. I mean, how could I be an alcoholic and been able to stay sober 7 years? And maybe after 7 years, maybe I could pick up and I could just, you know, I could take it or leave it alone now, because maybe I'm grown up now, you know, and that stuff is going on in my head. And so the moral of that story is, had I been close to my sponsor or my higher power or my home group or a sober support network or any of those things, maybe I would have said to somebody, hey, man, I'm starting to think some crazy stuff. And maybe somebody would have given me some perspective. And maybe I would have done some things to kind of get back in realignment. But none of that stuff was there anymore, because I had kind of, you know, set it up that way that it wouldn't be there anymore, right? And so the insanity comes, and then the day comes, and I remember I pick up the drink, and I'll never forget. I'm in the Lower East Side, and I'm at this bar with this girl that I'd been dating. And I say, well, you know what? Tonight's as good a night as any night. And I start drinking, and I remember this smile on my face from ear to ear, because it was this feeling of like being reunited with the love of my life. I mean, I can't tell you, that feeling that I had was like, oh, I remember this, the flutter in my heart, the way that it went down my throat. I mean, I was just there. And I remember thinking, God, I should have done this years ago. Right? Now, look, when I relapsed, and this was, I don't know, let's say 2000, right? 2000. My sobriety date, just so everybody's clear, my sobriety date is January 1st of 2007, right? So from 2000 to 2007, I had periods of sobriety and I had periods of drunkenness. But in those 7 years, man, I would hit new bottoms and new lows. I basically got to the point where I started to think of myself as, I'm going to be that guy that is the chronic relapser in my group. I'm going to be that guy that eventually they find me dead somewhere. And that's just the way it's going to be. I'm never going to be able to put any significant time together again. And that's just the way it is. And I just became that guy. So let's see, we're at 7:04. All right. So let me get into this. We've been going through in the last year, and this year seems to be a continuation, but we'll stick with 2020. I understand why many people feel 2020 is probably the worst year that they've lived through. And I guess collectively as a whole, it probably is the worst year that many of us have lived through. And as a society, very, 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 I mean, horrible, horrible year. But I have to look at it from this point of view. 2020, while it was a difficult year for many people, and it was a difficult year, it was by no means my worst year. In fact, in certain ways, you know, there were things about 2020 that were okay. And, you know, the way I look at it is this, and I understand for anybody who lost somebody or anybody who suffered through this, I get it, right? I mean, I get that people suffered. All I'm trying to say is I've come to the realization that my internal experience, the way I experience the world, has little to do with about the outside circumstances and way more to do with the inside. Because I found out for me, I could do phenomenal on a horrible day, and I could do horrible on a beautiful day, right? It really doesn't matter in a certain respect. So I'll tell you my worst year, the one that I would identify as, for me personally, my worst year. And that year was 2006. What a horrible year. 2006 was a horrendous year. 2006 was like the bottom of the barrel. And at that point, I'd gotten to this place where I was wishing for the end. You know, they describe it in the big book as pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And that's where I was. I was at the jumping off place. I couldn't imagine my life with it or without it. And I was hoping for death. But see, I was afraid to actually kill myself because, like I said before, I was a good Catholic boy. And somewhere along the way in my Catholic education, I heard something about God not being too keen on suicides, you know? And so the insanity for me at that point is I no longer believe in God, but what if, you know what I mean? Like my luck, I don't believe in God and then he happens to actually exist. And how horrible would that be at the end of a very bad life? You have to go face that guy and he tells you it's going to be like eternity in a lake of fire or like 10,000 years in purgatory. And God, that would be a bummer, you know? So I wanted to hedge my bets. I mean, this, I'm insane, but I'm thinking, all right, I'm not going to do it to myself like per se, but I'm hoping that some act of God will take me out. Like I live on the 20th floor of my building. I'm hoping that the cable snaps. I'm driving my car. I'm hoping somebody goes out of control and hits me head on. These are the kinds of thoughts that I'm thinking. Every once in a while, I have one of those sober thoughts where I go, God, things are getting dark. It got to the point for me in 2006 where I finally came to my senses and I said, I have to do something about this because I can't. It was like when we talk about being sick and tired of being sick and tired, I can't live like this anymore. And that thought came to me and I said, listen, I know what my problem is. I've known it for a long time. I got the thing. Once I start, I can't stop. Once I stop, I can't stay stopped. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I got that. I know it. I know that the solution to my problem is spiritual in nature. I know where to go to find the solution to my problem. I know about AA meetings. I know where to go, right? I have all of that information. I have all of that knowledge, but the bad news for people like us is that this is an illness that defies logic and rationality. I can have all the information in the world about alcoholism as an illness, but I don't seem to have the power to be able to do something significant about it. I don't have the power to be able to fix my own problem. That's my dilemma. And I'm having this conversation with myself because I talk to myself like a crazy person and I'm going, okay, I'm going to go back to AA. I'm going back to AA. And then I hear this voice and the voice sounds a lot like my voice. And the voice says, whoa, 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 wait, wait. Voice says, you're right. We do need to go back to AA and we will go back to AA, but there's one hitch. I'm talking to myself, right? Or at least what I think is myself. Because, you know, we talk about how I have an illness that talks to me in my own voice. I'm pretty sure what's really talking to me is my illness, but I think it's me. And the voice goes, listen, we're going to go back to AA, but here's the thing. My friend Joe, he'd been traveling around the world for the last year and a half, and he was coming back to New York in December. And how disappointed would Joe be if when he came back, I was in AA? You know what I mean? That wouldn't be right. So the voice says, listen, this is what we'll do. We'll go back to AA, but you know when we'll go? And everybody here knows when I'll go. January 1st, 2007. And why? Because that's a perfect sobriety date. It's the first day of a new year. It's like a clean slate. It's like pristine snow. It's pure. It's beautiful. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, that's a great idea. I'm talking to myself. This is the whole thing that's going on inside my head. It's a heist. I've been hijacked. I don't even know it. Because here's the deal. I'm dying of alcoholism. It's killing me. And I'm having this conversation in my head that, well, I'll wait to January 1st because Joe is going to be disappointed that I'm in AA. That's how insane I am. But I don't see that. I don't see that that's insanity. And so what happens? I'm going through December and December is just flying by. And I have this pit in my stomach because I'm afraid when January 1st comes, I'm going to fly right through it. Because the reality is I've never been able to say this is the date and then stick with it. So I'm afraid. But I really do want to come back to AA because I really am suffering. I really am suffering. And then the most beautiful thing that could happen to a guy like me happened to a guy like me. And what it was New Year's Eve 2006. That's my last day. I'm going to get done. I got to get done. If anybody knows anything about, you know, alcoholism, you got to get done. So I'm going to get done. And I'm getting done. And I'm with my ex-girlfriend in our old apartment, and we're getting done, you know, we're getting done. And we're talking, and then the next thing I know, lights out, right? And then the next thing I know is I'm being resuscitated. You know, it's like, you know, when I drink, it's like I have a magnetic appeal to people in uniforms. You know, they just seem to show up wherever I am. And once again, I'm surrounded by people in uniforms, and I'm being resuscitated. And I'm going, what happened? And they tell me, they go, well, listen, you know, you swallowed your tongue, your lips are blue. You'd be a McNugget if it wasn't for her. She's in the corner crying. And I'm going, what do you mean? And they, you know, explain to me what happened. And they put me in a gurney and they take me down to the ambulance and they take me to the ER. And as I'm going, all these thoughts are going through my head because I'm thinking, but that's crazy. The plan was I was going to get sober tomorrow. And the other thought that's going on in my head is going, but you died tonight. And then I'm thinking, oh my God, how many times has this happened to people like us? You know, because we always do, I'm going to go to rehab tomorrow. I'm going to go to the meeting tomorrow. Like we have power. And I remember, I can't tell you how many times I heard it in the rooms of AA, and it was usually from an old timer, and they'd say something like this. They'd go, if I go out and drink tonight, there's no guarantee I'll come back because I could die. And I'd say, oh my God, you're so dramatic. You know, like this is another person trying to scare me clean and sober. Here it is, old timer. I bet if you drink, you're not going to die tonight. I bet you, right? And that's me being a cynic and sarcastic. Oh, now here I am. I'm in the gurney and I'm being taken to the hospital, and I'm making that connection in my head. Oh my God, this is what they've been talking about, right? This thing about, I think I got tomorrow's promise to me and nothing's promised to me. And then it was like this feeling of like, and I know a lot of people in this room will understand this. And it was this feeling of total despair. I just felt like I was the world's biggest loser. I felt like such a low life. I felt like nothing is going right in my life. In fact, probably the world would have been better off had I never been born. And I just felt so sorry for myself. And I felt like, you know, I started thinking about, geez, I have, at that point, my daughter was 10 years old. And I started thinking, oh my God, you know, what would it be like for her, right? If I had died and for the rest of her life, she had to wonder why her dad was such a loser. You know, that's in my head. Like, why didn't daddy love me? That he wouldn't stick around for me, that drugs and alcohol were more important to him than I was. I started thinking about my family and like how they would have thought, you know, was there something I could have said different? Was there something I could have done for this guy? Was there something? And I started thinking about all those people. I started thinking about the people in AA. I started thinking about you guys going, oh, you remember? Yeah, you remember Troche? Yeah, he used to be a big book thumper. Well, he's real spiritual now. You know, whether he went up or down, he's gone, right? And I didn't want to be a cautionary tale for you people. And I didn't want to be, you know, the memory of a tragedy to my family. I mean, it's like all of a sudden it was like the experience of Ebenezer Scrooge when at the end of his ordeal on Christmas, with Christmas past, present, and future. And I just was like, I'll do anything to get out of this thing that I'm in. I'll do anything. And I just said the most sincere prayer that I'd ever said in my life. And I said, if you get me out of this one, I swear to God, I will do anything. I will never take it for granted again. I will never do that again. I will promise you, I will do this thing for real. Just please help me. Please help me. And that was the beginning. And you know, what's amazing is like, you know, we talk about what's good and what's bad. And I don't know what's good and I don't know what's bad all the time. Sometimes things that I think are good turn out to be bad. Sometimes things I think are bad turn out to be good. This was a case of that. Man, when that stuff happened, I thought it was so bad. You know, I just thought it was like my life was over. This was as bad as it gets. And the reality is that actually turned out to be like the best thing in my life, because that event was like, it had this impact on me mentally, emotionally, spiritually, where I was just willing to do whatever I had to do. And then my journey started, and my journey back into AA was not a happy one, by the way. Those early months were not good. I didn't get the same release that I had that first time, where the obsession to drink was just, you know, taken from me at that third meeting. Didn't have that. I struggled for a long time, and it felt like, you know, I would walk around and I would think to myself, God, every day I got through, it was like I'm one day closer to feeling normal again. But then there was this fear underneath that. And the fear was, God, what if I did so much damage to myself that this is what sobriety is going to be like for the rest of my life? And if there's anybody in here that is feeling that thing, that you think you're new and you think that sobriety is going to be fighting a drink for the rest of your life, if it was, none of us would want it. If that's what sobriety was, none of us would want it. I wouldn't want it, you know? So I just want to tell you that, like, this quick story, and then we could probably wrap it up. But what happened was this. I can't tell you if it was like 6 months, 8 months, 10 months. I don't know. But it was within my first year sober. And I'm at a meeting, and the guy at the front of the meeting, you know, he's at the podium, and he says this. He goes, you know, sometimes I'm like happy for like no reason whatsoever. And it's weird because I don't even have like any right to be happy. Like there's nothing really good in my life, you know, like nothing special, but I'm happy. It's a really weird thing. And I'm sitting there, I go, oh my God, I feel that way. Now I start thinking, well, when the hell did that start happening? Because like I said, I was miserable. Those first few months sober were horrible. And now I'm at this meeting, right, in my first year, and I'm going, oh my God, I feel happy for no reason. When did that happen? And then the guy said this. He goes, you know, the other thing is, I can't tell you the last time I really thought I'd want to pick up a drink or get drunk. And that's amazing. And I said, oh my God, I don't know either. When's the last time I wanted to pick up a drink? Now, in those early weeks and months, every single day, the obsession, I couldn't get rid of it every day. And now I'm sitting in this meeting and I'm trying to put my finger on when this changed, and I can't. And what I can tell you is that at some point early on, I got myself a sponsor and I began going through the steps. And some point along the way, it's almost as if I was focusing on the steps and I was focusing on what we focus on in AA, and then God did what God does. I don't know, but something happened in my life and it changed. Now, the thing that's significant for me about that is that was the recognition, that moment in that meeting, the recognition that something had changed inside of me. And I can tell you, you know, I just celebrated 14 years last month. From that moment when I recognized that to this moment today, I can tell you there has not been one time where I thought about, I'd like to pick up a drink, I'd like to go get lit up, I'd like to do it. Just I don't have that thought. And that's like, I don't realize what a miracle that is sometimes. Like I was a guy, I couldn't stay sober 14 days. 14 hours was a stretch. How does a guy that can't do that for 14 days or 14 hours, they can be clean and sober for 14 years? How does that happen? Right? And I don't fight it. And it's kind of like, here's the menu. And on the menu, everything got added to the menu, and what got taken off were alcohol and its friends, you know? That's not on the menu anymore. I think there's a meme that I've seen, like seen it a couple times on social media. And it says something like, addiction is trading everything for one thing, and recovery is gaining everything for one thing, right? And for me, there is so much freedom in the fact that my life isn't wrapped up in, I got to get it, I need it, I hate how I feel, I want to kill people, I want to choke somebody. My life isn't wrapped up in that stuff. My life is wrapped up in God. God's given me so many gifts. Like there's so many things in life that are like really like what gives life its meaning and purpose. It's really what makes it worth living. And I couldn't see any of that stuff when I was in active alcoholism. And I lose sight of all of that stuff when I'm in abstinence, but I'm not in recovery. I lose sight of it. Where I see it is where I really live this way of life. For me, what it looks like is it's a spiritual program of action. There's 12 steps that we get to take. There's a very specific, listen, I'm not one of these guys that's going to tell you can only do it one way, because I don't believe that. But I do believe in the instructions in the big book. That's how I took the steps. That's what changed my life, gave me direction, purpose, meaning. And then the last thing is like, for what? So that when when that stuff happens in my life, it's not so that I can skip off into the sunset and say, thanks a lot, AA, now I got mine, you go get yours. But that happens for me. And the way that I get to keep it in my life is I turn around and try to be of service to others. Now, I'm not going to pretend like I'm some kind of holy roller, like I'm, Jesus walking among the people, because that's not it either. But the idea that a selfish, self-centered, egotistical person like myself, or at least the way that I used to be, could turn into someone that actually thinks about other people, that actually values service. And I see it like this. The idea is enlightened self-interest, right? I'm never going to get completely and totally devoid of self. What I get is I recognize that there are things in this world that we can do, and it's a win-win. It's kind of like, why do we want clean air and clean water? Because if we have clean air and clean water, it'll be a benefit for you, and it'll be a benefit for me, and it'll also be a benefit for future people. And that's kind of the idea of service. I do service, and you better believe I get something out of it, but so do you. And that's the thing. And so, what I've come to in my time in recovery is that everything that we do, or everything that we're given in this thing, is so that we can turn around and be of service to other people. The worst things that ever happened in my life turn out to have value because I could use it to help other people. It just changes the whole game. And anyway, so we're at the end. I just wanted to say thank you for letting me tell you a little bit about my story. I hope there was something in there that is useful for at least somebody. And then I guess the next part is a break, and then we do questions. So thank you very much for letting me be of service tonight. Thank you.
John, thank you so much. That was amazing. Everybody has the ability to unmute and thank John real quickly before we...
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John. Thank you. I love
Thanks,
that.
John. Fantastic.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
John.
Thank you,
sir.
Thank you, John.
Thank you so much, John. That was amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah. I remember that. All right. I'm going to take the meeting back for a moment. We'll give John a break. I'm going to remind everybody that that Larry is under the user questions. Please chat your questions for John to the user questions. Really, it's Larry, but send Larry your questions, please. And we're going to pass the Seven Tradition basket virtually. I've placed links to our PayPal account in the chat. The Seventh Tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seventh Tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting take place. I'll take a few announcements for the good of AA by show of hands. Anybody got an announcement? Ebony! Oh, let me give you back your bullets here. There you go.
Hey y'all, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ebony. John, thank you so much for that beautiful share. District 14 Norfolk is hosting a 12 concepts workshop. Don't know what the concepts are? It's a great place to find out. It's going to be this Wednesday at 7 p.m. on Zoom. I'll make sure that the info gets put in the chat. We will be having David H., who is the alternate chair for the VAC. He will be speaking on concept 2, 12 traditions, 12 steps, 12 concepts. We'll have him speak for about 30 minutes, take a break for announcements and such, and then open it up for questions and answers. Hope to see you all there. It's a great time. Thanks.
Thank you, Ebony. Anybody else? I don't see any other hands. Going once. Going twice. There's also Evan D. Go ahead, brother.
Hey, thanks, David. There's a new meeting, Campus Big Book Study. It's on Wednesday nights, 8:15 to 9:30. I'll drop the link in the chat, and we'd love to have you there. Thanks.
Thank you. District 24 is doing a service workshop next Saturday, and the concepts workshop that Ebony talked about, that's also in the chat, the District 24, all of that can be found at tidewaterintergroup.org as well. Is that it?
Lance.
All right. Let's see. I lost my place in the script. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. So once again, let's get those questions rolling. I'm going to change screens and see what we got. John, that was amazing. Thank you so much. I love the, I just had a couple of comments here. I just made a note of your description of untreated alcoholism. I'm easily annoyed and never satisfied. I just thought that was a nice compact way of describing that. And I also find it interesting that you were sitting in your third AA meeting reading a book on how to find God. So I don't know if there's any comments in there you want to expand on, but I have a first question. Did you ever relapse while you were sponsoring someone?
No. isn't that weird? Right?
Right.
I mean, the short answer is no. I mean, I'm sure I know that's happened for other people, but my story, I never in any of my relapses, and there were a few of them, was I sponsoring at the time. So says a lot.
Right on. Let's see. Next question is, in your previous times in AA, did you just go to meetings or did you do the steps?
Yeah, so I was really lucky because that first meeting that I told you about, that first home group, it actually turned out to be the best home group in all of Alcoholics Anonymous, bar none. I mean, for me, and as far as I was concerned, if that's what I felt, that's just the way it is. This is the best. I mean, I had, and it was just out of, I don't know, luck, whatever. That's the meeting that I ended up going to. And that turned out to be a big book, 12-step, higher power meeting, a group. And they weren't interested, by the way. At that time, the old-timers there, they weren't interested in any nonsense. You know, if you wanted to debate with them about the 12 steps, it's, well, then go somewhere else. We don't care. You know, and it was funny because I actually – that worked for me, you know, like somebody being like hard with me, like that kind of, at that time in my life worked. And so, yeah, the first time I came in, I had a 12-step experience, did them out of the book. There were times in the middle when obviously I would come and just go to the meetings, and that didn't seem to work so well.
You talked a lot about service, and someone wants to know, can you tell us more about your service in AA? What do you do? What do you like to do? What do you enjoy?
Yeah. So, all right. So it started really in that first group. there was a guy, his name was Ron. He was a member of that group. And it turned out he was the DCM of the county. I didn't know that. I didn't even know what a DCM was. And me and my buddy Tommy, we were in competition for Rookie of the Year in AA. You know, like the two of us were, trying to beat each other for who could do more and look better, you know, that kind of thing. And he got the two of us together and he said, you know, I've been watching you guys and you guys are really doing good stuff. Have you guys ever heard about General Service? And neither one of us had, you know, we were kind of like, no. And he goes, well, listen, we have this meeting on Wednesday nights at this church. I'd love for you guys to come and get involved in General Service. Now, neither one of us really wanted to go, but we couldn't say that in front of each other because we're going for Rookie of the Year, you know? So we go, okay. And that Wednesday night I show up and Tommy didn't. I got a resentment on that one, but I got hooked into this thing called General Service, right? Basically it started out, I got to that meeting and I noticed the guys that were there were some of the heavy hitters in the county, guys that I knew from other groups. And wow, that guy, you know, to me, they were like the who's who of like the most recovered people in the world. And they're all at this like secret cabal meeting, you know, they were like the Illuminati. And I was like, wow, what is this? And Ron took me after the meeting and he goes, listen, I want to tell you something about being here. If you're here, you are not on the fringes of AA. This is the inn of the inn. And I was like, oh, that's what I want. I want to be the inn of the inn, you know? And that was what hooked me, right? Was that. And so what did I do? I was a GSR. I did committee work. I was on Bridging the Gap. I was in treatment facilities. I did cooperation with the professional community. Later on, I became an alternate DCM and a DCM. I did DCM a couple times actually. And then, you know, and then serve, and then other forms of service, obviously sponsorship. A lot of workshops, like putting together workshops, putting together retreats, putting together conferences, and then, you know, speaking at events like that too. So that's, I mean, I think, you know, that's basically, that's basically it in a nutshell. Yeah.
What was the double secret cabal? Was it like district or intergroup or something?
I'm not sure. It sounds like you guys are in Virginia, but maybe I'm wrong. But in New York, our area is called Sini, Southeast New York. And in Sini, we have an extra layer on our general service structure called the county level. So you have districts and districts, the next level up from the districts is the county. So it was a general service meeting for the county and Ron was the DCMC of the county at that time.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little different. We are in Virginia, and so we have an intergroup in our area that links four districts, and we're all part of Area 71, Virginia. So the next question, I am newly sober and still wake up hoping today is the day I feel better. Mm-hmm. How do you keep hope when those things are not happening? How can I stay focused on the prize? At times, this is all overwhelming, and I need some hope.
Yeah, so that's exactly where I was. I mean, when I was new this last time around, I got to tell you, it really, like I said, that fear that I had about maybe I did so much damage to myself that I'm never going to get out of this, that was a very real fear to me. Like, I really was nervous about that. The only thing that I had, the advantage that I had over somebody that never had an experience in AA was that I knew that in the past I had come to AA and eventually was able to feel comfortable in my own skin. I knew that because I had the experience. Like, I knew that that was a possibility, but I really was struggling with that thing in my head. And I would say to the person who asked that question, I know that that's a tough place to be because your head is telling you, it's not going to work. It's telling you that. And, you know, you might, if you've gone to treatment or rehab, you might've heard of post-acute withdrawal syndrome, right? Which can sometimes last for a very long time, where you are in this spot where you just feel like it's never going to get better. But I'm telling you, it will, right? But you just have to have, you have to have the patience and the perseverance. And so what we say to people in a spot like that where you're in is stay close to the people in AA. This is where the fellowship is really important. The fellowship, when I was in that spot, you know what would get me through? We'd go to the meeting, and then after the meeting, the people of AA were like babysitters. They babysat me. We would go to people's apartments. We would go play Scrabble, play cards, play poker. We'd go to the movies. We'd go to the diner. We'd watch a movie and something. We were always doing something. And they, and I didn't know it at the time, but they were babysitting me. And that would get me through one more day, which would get me through one more day, which eventually got me to that place where I got free.
Right on. Did somebody wants to know, did you feel the need to finish the book you were reading in that third meeting?
I did finish that book. It was a great book. And I had been reading that book for a little while. And then, obviously, like I said, my first sponsor had given me given me my first big book. And, the big book, at least my experience has been, the way it comes alive is when you have somebody who's gone through the book take you through it. My experience would be like, initially my sponsor would be like, all right, read the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, and then we'll talk about it. And I'd read it and I'd be like, what the hell am I reading? But then when I would sit down with him and we'd go through it together, he would point out all the stuff that I couldn't even say. Holy crap, I didn't see that, right? So for me, the big book comes alive when you have somebody else kind of showing you, well, this is what they were talking about here, and this is what they're getting at here, and see how they echo the same point over and over and over again. Look at that, and that kind of changed the game for me.
Is that how you work with others today? You go through the book together?
Yeah. I just find that to be the most effective, just to go line by line through the book. And then, there was, I don't know if you are all familiar with some speakers back, from back in the day, specifically Joe Hawk and Mark Houston. But that idea of going through the book like that, and basically whenever it makes a statement, you turn the statement into a question, was like this, not, back then was like, wow, that's like revolutionary. So, and like Joe was famous for saying, be the man of consideration. Don't say that yes or no to the answer, consider it, right? And that even goes to, okay, like, let's take a look at alcoholism, right? Do you have the physical craving? Once you start, can you stop? And ask yourself that question from the point of view of being a person of consideration. Those ideas were helpful, because what happens is if you have somebody do it that way, you're not saying you're an alcoholic, you're letting them draw their own conclusion. And I think that's way more powerful for a person to have their own experience like that. Then I go, well, this is what an alcoholic is. You seem to fit that, so you're an alcoholic. Like, wait, no, I'm not. Don't tell me I am, right? But if you go, the funniest thing with alcoholics, if you go, well, maybe you are an alcoholic, maybe you're not. They go, no, I'm an alcoholic. What do you mean? I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah. We can't stand to be excluded from anything.
Yeah.
How has the current COVID situation impacted working with others and your recovery program over the last 10 months or so?
Well, it has, in the sense that I haven't been able to do much face to face. I've done a lot of Zoom calls, and I've done what is that app? WhatsApp. Been doing it that way, which is like, I've never, before this happened, I never would have done that, right? I never would have, sat on the phone with somebody and did it, or, on a video call. But, the circumstances merit it. And so it turns out you could do that too, right? So yeah, it's affected it. But I think that, You know, what's amazing is that I work in treatment. So I work with a lot of people who are, you know, they're in a facility trying to get well, and we connect them with sponsors. And, you know, to be in our program, you have to have a sponsor and make progress in the steps. So all of them, they're doing the same thing too. And I got to say, man, it, for anybody who's new right now, I mean, how amazing to be getting clean and sober during COVID-19. Like, if you make it, man, you got hands down over everybody else, you know, and you'll have sponsees that'll complain to you in the future about how they can't do shit. And you can say, right, you'll say, shut the hell up. I got sober in COVID-19, you weak person, right? Like, you could yell at them, right? Like, you have the Trump card. So we're not worthy to all of you getting sober right now.
How would you describe what you're doing this time around to avoid slipping back into that? The word is ambivalence, but I think it's complacency toward the program or indifference, you know, just falling out.
Yeah. So that's kind of like an interesting question in the sense that what am I doing? I don't know if it's something that I'm doing. Meaning, like, I don't know if it's something that I create in myself, but there's something inside of me that I want to live this way of life. I'm not trying to paint myself as some kind of angel, like I do things perfectly, because I don't. But when I make mistakes, I want to fix the mistakes. I want to. I don't want to like sneak around going, oh, I made a mistake, but I don't want to. Like, I want to fix it. Right. I want to make amends. I have a prayer life. I have a meditation life. I'm committed to service. If you think about the AA way of life, like what we're doing, it seems really complicated when you're new, and it can be really cumbersome. And it seems like there's a lot of different ideas. But I think over time, if you really look at it, there's only like four or five different like ideas there. You know, like we're trying to, if my issue is I'm powerless over something, whatever I'm powerless over, my solution has to include getting connected to some kind of power, right? If I don't have power over something, I need to get some power. And so for me, the way at least I look at it is, you know, step one is I'm powerless over this thing. Step two is I have to get some power in my life. And then the rest of the step is how do I connect to that power on a daily basis? And I find that, you know, when I look at it from a very simplistic point of view of being connected to the power, I look at it like my cell phone, right? Like my smartphone. It's an amazing device. I could do a lot of things with it. I can surf the web. I could watch movies. I could play games. I could send emails. I could even make phone calls on it. I'm on a Zoom meeting right now with you good people in Virginia. I mean, there's all these great things I could do with the phone, right? But it has a design flaw. The design flaw of the phone is that inherently in and of itself, it doesn't have power, right? So constantly every single day, and I'm sure you have this experience too, I have to make sure that I'm plugging this thing into, in fact, my phone, the one that I'm using right now is plugged into power, right? And so I have one by my bed. I have one by my desk. I have one in my car. I have one in the office at work, right? And I make sure that every single day I have access to power so that my phone is usable. Because once my phone runs out of power, just like yours, it's effectively a paperweight, right? You can't do much with it, right? So much like the phone, I look at like myself, kind of like that. I have to just make sure I'm plugged into power every single day. The power is flowing through. I have a relationship with the power in my life. And I just, for me, that works, right? And I don't know if that's something that I am like creating or fabricating in me. I just, that's there, right? And that's kind of where my head's at with it.
Right on. How important is the fellowship in your recovery today?
Oh man, the fellowship is so important. And it's, you know what? I think we've all come to this conclusion with the COVID-19 situation, how much we miss it. You know, like, I don't know what it's like over near you, but we have a couple of meetings around here that are live, but I mean, they're few and far between. And it's like when I'm able to get to a live meeting, it's just like, oh man, just to be in the room with other people and feel that and be able to see people that, you know, I know and I have history with, and, you know, that there's something about that. And thank God for the Zoom. I mean, Zoom's great and it's allowed us to connect in different ways. But I think that, you know, compared to being live, it's just, it's a different animal. And so, you know, the fellowship is, you know, the other thing about the fellowship too, is it's so powerful. It's such a powerful thing that you've seen it. We've all seen this. If you've been around for a while, people who have been able to stay sober for like significant periods of time doing really nothing else but going to meetings. I mean, they want to club you over the head like a baby seal, right? And they're like, they're super mad, right? You don't really want what they have, but they're not drinking, right? So like, there is real juice and real power in the fellowship. There's something about being a part of a community. And it's something that we've lost in society, because we're really, if you think about how tribal we are these days, and everybody's on their phone and everybody's social media, and the social media, it's kind of like this, it's like this level of anonymity that we have, that you could just kind of, you could not be a part of certain people and connect with other people. It's just a weird thing. But the community aspect, I think that that's a big part of who, of what we are as human beings. We need it.
How do you encourage a sponsee to take action?
How do I encourage? I mean, I just said, well, I was, I'll say, if somebody, if I'm working with somebody and they don't want to do it, I kind of say, well, you asked me to sponsor you. And if you don't want to do this, then I don't know if I'm the right guy for you. And that's okay. You know, like if you want a, like if you want somebody to just be a friend, I could be a friend. But if you're looking for a sponsor, this is kind of how this works, is like, I'm going to help you go through the steps. If you're not interested in going through the steps, you're missing the whole point of what the sponsorship relationship is. Right. I mean, I, like I said, we can talk if you want to just talk, like if you just, okay, but that's not me being your sponsor. That's just me being your pal. Right.
What, do you have any tips you could offer for people who want to take the steps but do not have an in-person meeting near them?
Oh, okay. Well, I think that, like I said before, you can find people, you can find people online that can take you through the process. I mean, I'm working with, what the hell is that called again? I'm working with a woman who lives in Bermuda right now. I've never met her, but she had a mutual friend and she wanted to go through the steps again. And we got connected over like WhatsApp. In fact, I think when I get off, I got to give her a call to see, she had reached out to me earlier. So it's like, you know, I think that, like I said, look, the times are what they are. And if you can't find somebody near you that can take you through the steps because of what we're going through, you know, you kind of have to be creative. So there's plenty of people, listen, there's plenty of people out there. That's actually kind of the cool part about it, is like, now you're not limited to just your small pool of people that you know in your little network. If you really wanted to reach out to, like, you know, the greatest sponsor in the world, you could find them right online and work with them, you know, over the phone if you were so inclined, right? So yeah, I think it's still doable.
Right on. I don't know if the person who asked this question is going through this, but I'll just read the question. What would you do if your sponsor went back out?
Oh my God. So I'll tell you this, my sponsor about a year ago almost died. It was the craziest thing. So, but this is a little bit different question. When you said that, you made me think of this. So I, my God, I want to tell you this story because it's such a good story, but it really doesn't have to do with the question.
Please.
But so basically AA saved my sponsor's life. It was it's the craziest story. It was like, I used to work on Monday nights, you know, before all the pandemic stuff. And it was a Monday night where it turned out I didn't have to work. And so I reached out to my sponsor and I said, hey, you know that Monday meeting you go to, is it open tonight? And he goes, yes. As a matter of fact, I'm speaking there tonight. Do you want to speak with me? I go, sure, I'd love to speak with you there. So I meet him there at the meeting. The meeting's about to start, and he gets up and he goes, I have to go. I go, what the, like, this guy asked me to speak with him and now he's leaving. So, okay. Well, come to find out, he left because he felt sick. He went to the parking lot, and before he got to his car, he sat down and he said, I'm just going to sit down for a while. Okay. Now, a guy that he's been sponsoring, a guy named Frank, he's been sponsoring Frank for years. And Frank is a serial relapser. I mean, Frank loves smoking crack. I got to be honest with you. He's a crack smoking maniac. And Frank will get like a few months together and relapse. And he's done it hundreds of times. And anybody else, including myself, would have gotten rid of Frank years ago. But my sponsor happens to be one of those good guys that just keeps working with Frank. Well, lo and behold, who shows up at the meeting but Frank? And Frank looks at Bob and Frank says, you don't look good. And Bob says, I think I'm okay. Bob's one of those guys, he could lose a limb. He's not going to go to the hospital. And Frank looks at him and he goes, you got to go to the hospital. Frank forces him to go to the hospital. He gets to the hospital, and at the hospital, they tell him, you are in the process of having a major heart attack. And because Frank took him there, he survived it. Frank saved his life. Now, the craziest thing, he shows up to the AA meeting to be of service. A guy that he never gave up on shows up and takes him to the hospital. And what that tells me is you never know, right, when you're working with people, when they might turn around and save your life. So now I'm not firing sponsees anymore after that experience. But it was amazing. But if my sponsor was to relapse, I would feel bad, and I would, you know, try to be of assistance if I could be, but then I'd have to find another sponsor.
Once again, I hope the 90 minutes went as quickly for you as it did for me. This was amazing. We are out of time. Everybody will get the opportunity to thank John again after we say the Lord's Prayer. What an amazing meeting, John. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank everybody who participated, Larry, for wrangling the questions. And could I get a home group member? I'm going to share the screen to read the last few paragraphs on page 164, please.
Thanks, David. Okay.
we're going to get this down one day.
My name's Leanne. I'm an alcoholic. A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, and thank you all. Let's virtually circle up, hold hands, have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Thank you, John. That was amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John. Thank you, John. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks,
for having
John.
Me.
Thank you, John.
Privilege.
Take care, everybody.
You too. Thank you. Brother.